Good evening. I'm Doug Miller, and this is Amandla Radio from CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal with my coverage of the World AIDS Conference that ended just last week here in Montreal. In 1997, Ethel Manda died in Makupo Village, Malawi, of an HIV-related cause. She was one of millions back then in Africa who were suffering and dying. Around 650,000 people died from HIV-related causes last year, in 2021, while 1.5 million people became newly infected. The conference started, HIV concert started here with activists storming the stage to protest the inadequate response of wealthy governments to the growing monkeypox outbreak. Let me tie all that together over the course of this show.
We're at AIDS 2022, where a monkeypox treatment activism protest has just disrupted the morning plenary, just as Dimitri Daskalakis of the CDC was planned to speak. There's been a lot of criticism of the CDC and the U.S. government in general for not acting more quickly to stem the spread of monkeypox among gay men in the United States. Let's hear what they have to say.
In line to get shots for monkeypox. It's completely I'm sad to say that I feel like a refugee in Canada. I had to come all the way here to another progressive country to get a shot that I should be able to get in my very wealthy country. So I'm extremely disappointed at the CDC. Once again, you all dropped the ball, especially in New York, which seems to be a place where we're getting targeted, of course. Everything for us is community-led. We're not getting any help. I just think it's very sad as a black trans man of experience that we're not even included in the conversation. Actually, I didn't hear you mention trans women or trans men at all. So I have problems with that as well, too. But I will say, and I'm going to keep it short, that I do find it so disturbing and disgusting. I pay taxes, I work just like everyone else, and I cannot get adequate health care with health insurance. Thank you.
For me, with family in Makupo Village, Malawi, HIV/AIDS is a deeply personal affair. 10 of my in-laws in a village of 60 people are living with HIV today because they got tested, started treatment, and now live productive lives. They were the lucky ones after 2008. Even then, one of them is permanently crippled by a disease that AIDS fostered, and another is blind. Nonetheless, they are still alive, while our family cemetery covers the bodies of many who did not survive long enough for the tragically slow response of the rich world to react to activists and community pressure and set up the Global Fund for HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis. Millions of Africans had to die before this could happen. Even then, inequality was evident. The recent conference was the 24th International AIDS Society conference on HIV/AIDS, and the second in Montreal. Its first time in Montreal in 1989, history was made when the New York founding chapter of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP New York, drove up to Montreal by bus for the conference, joined by Canadian activists from AIDS Action Now and Réaction SIDA. Some 300 protesters stormed the stage at the opening ceremony. From there on in, activists and community groups have been an integral part of these conferences previously run by bureaucrats, medical professionals, and academic researchers. Montreal, and particularly its HIV activists, many of them from the LGBTQ2 communities, but also medical doctors, researchers, and academics committed early on in the AIDS pandemic to forcing action on a disease that much of society wanted to brush under the carpet. It was common to hear people say that it was a gay or Haitian disease until relatives and friends became affected and began to die. Here in Montreal, a coalition, in French, Coalition des Organismes Communautaires Québécois de Lutte Contre le Sida, or the Coalition of Community Organizations of Quebec for the Fight Against AIDS, has led a vigorous discussion by local community organizations, and before the conference started, they set out the Montreal Manifesto. Their manifesto reads, HIV disease remains a worldwide epidemic affecting all countries. We have made much progress on medical responses to HIV, but these are not accessible to all. Progress on non-medical aspects of HIV is blocked by coercive and moralistic policies and actions that have no place in considerations of health. They go on for quite a while in all of their chapters. I'm just going to skim over it briefly. That was the preamble. They make very clear connection between access to health and solving the HIV problem as a human right. And it starts by simply saying every person has the right to a standard of living adequate for their health and well-being, as well as that of their families, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care. They also go on to talk about prevention. And they say governments and education structures must ensure sufficient sexual health education for all, including information campaigns for the general public. All people are entitled to free and unfettered access to information and the tools for prevention, including pharmaceutical and barrier methods for prevention, harm reduction information and supplies, safe drug supply. And the maintenance of an undetectable HIV viral load must be recognized as effective prevention, as well as being a benefit to the person living with the HIV. For those who are unable to reach or maintain an undetectable HIV viral load, there exist other effective strategies and tools to prevent HIV transmission. Testing. Testing for HIV must be based on free and informed consent without the risk of losing other rights. All people must have free access to a broad range of testing options. Global equity. This is where I am really concerned. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis must be adequately funded, including targets that reflect actual needs to respond to HIV and the health needs of those living with or most exposed to HIV. They go on in that same category under equity. An international system of medication approval must be put in place to ensure timely access for new treatments for all. Supplies and equipment related to HIV prevention, care, treatment, support, and monitoring must be universally available. They go on to indicate that research would be really supported in order to help eliminate this disease as effectively as possible. I have here now the opening remarks by the UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima, who is a Ugandan by origin, and she is head, as I said, of the UN AIDS, and opened the conference with a presentation of their new report entitled In Danger. She's introduced by Professor Adiba Kamaralzam from the University of Malaysia, and so here they are.
I would now like to ask Dr. Adiba Kamaralzam, the President of the International AIDS Society, to open this launch event.
Thank you, Ben, and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the launch of the 2022 UNAIDS Global AIDS Update at AIDS 2022, the 24th International AIDS Conference. My name is Adiba Kamaruzaman, and I'm the current president of the International AIDS Society, the organizers of this conference. I'm very pleased to be here today. Thank you, UNAIDS, for inviting us to be amongst esteemed colleagues, and want to thank the City of Montreal. These are the sectors the International AIDS Conference bring together, so it is especially appropriate that UNAIDS is releasing their report here today. As you will hear, the key data in this year's global updates are troubling. We cannot afford to lose more ground in the global response to HIV. One of the figures that you will hear is that 70% of new HIV infections in 2021 occurred among key populations, which illustrates that the most marginalized are also the hardest hit. We urgently need to make resources available, close research gaps, and eliminate the stigma that still pervades thinking. Most crucially, we must ensure that scientists, policymakers, and activists come together to achieve progress. It's time to re-engage and follow the science. Today's panel include representation from government, civil society, and academia from across the globe. And we hope that you take away from today's conversation that, number one, we are not on track, but number two, we certainly can be. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you so much, Dr. Adiba. I would now like to ask Winnie Byanyima, the UNAIDS Executive Director, to launch the report.
Thank you, Ben. And good afternoon, good evening, good morning to all of you. The data we are sharing today brings painful but vital news. Our report, In Danger, is what we have called it, In Danger, reveals that the response to the AIDS pandemic has been derailed by global crises, from the colliding pandemics of HIV and COVID to the war in Ukraine and the resulting global economic crisis. Progress has been stalled. Inequalities have widened and resources have shrunk. Millions of lives are at risk. Here are some of the stark findings. New HIV infections dropped by only 3.6% between 2020 and 2021. This is the smallest annual decline since 2016. So 8 years ago, we are now, the decline in new infections has stalled. In Eastern Europe and Central Asia, in Latin America, and in the Middle East and North Africa regions, four regions, new HIV infections have been increasing every year over multiple years, over the last few years. But now in Asia and the Pacific, the world's most populous region, our data shows that for the first time, new infections are now rising in that region. Previously, they had been falling. So now another region, we're beginning to see declines in increase in new infections. In Eastern Southern Africa, where we have the fastest progress on reducing new infections and reducing deaths, even there we are seeing progress slowing significantly in 2021. There were 1.5 million new infections last year. This is more than 1 million above the global target. Last year, 2021, we lost one person every minute to an AIDS-related illness. One person every minute died last year. Even though we have the medicines needed to save those lives. If these trends continue, we could see 7.7 million additional AIDS-related deaths in this decade. So the multiple global crises have undermined services. Let me tell you how. The number of people on HIV treatment grew more slowly in 2021 than it has in over the last 10 years. So fewer people coming on treatment. Of all the children living with HIV, only a half, 52%, are on life-saving medicine. There's a huge inequality between children and adults in accessing treatment. And that gap is increasing. So we have to sound the alarm. UNAIDS is sounding the alarm. But let me be clear. This is not a council of despair. It is a call to action. Because even amidst these crises, we see remarkable resilience in some places. This report that we are releasing today shows us how to achieve an effective response. It is by addressing inequalities head on. What do I mean? First, inequalities in access to services. Our data show that HIV services aren't equally accessible. In some countries, it is the poor who lack access. In some, it is racial and ethnic minorities, such as in the UK, where the declines in new HIV diagnoses have been greater among white populations than among Black people. Or here in Canada, where the gap is growing between Indigenous people and other communities. In this report, you will find an inequalities analysis that shows some countries have achieved near equal access for the rich and poor, often because of having community-based and community-led services. Second, gender inequalities. Our data show that every 2 minutes in 2021, an adolescent girl or young woman was newly infected in HIV. Think about it. Every 2 minutes, a girl was being infected by HIV, or a young woman. COVID pushed millions of girls out of school. It brought spikes in teenage pregnancies and violence against women and girls. In sub-Saharan Africa, girls and young women are now 3 times as likely to acquire HIV as same age boys and men and young men. Effective pandemic response means addressing gender inequalities. Botswana, for example, extended universal secondary education. And Botswana found that for each additional year of schooling, there was a 12% reduction in girls' risk of acquiring HIV. So there are solutions. Economic inequalities. During COVID, debt repayments for the world's poorest countries have reached 171% of all spending on healthcare, education, and social protection combined. Debt repayments, 171% of total spending in the areas that can reduce HIV infections and deaths. Countries' capacities to respond to AIDS are being choked. Domestic funding for the HIV response in low and middle income countries has fallen for two consecutive years. But we can tackle inequality. We can tackle that economic inequality. In 2021, many of the most resilient AIDS responses, again, this is shown through our data, those responses where we had rapidly falling new infections and deaths, that is where we had national governments, PEPFAR, and the Global Fund working together to ensure that there was sufficient funding for the AIDS response, even during the crisis. So solutions are there. We can tackle these inequalities, but we must come together and invest the resources that are needed. And that happened in some countries during the crisis. Then inequalities in laws. Our data show that in 2021, key populations data shows that gay men and other men who have sex with men have 28 times the risk of acquiring HIV compared to people of the same age and gender identity. That's how big the gap is. Closing the inequalities by removing punitive laws, promoting human rights, and expanding community-led services is working in countries like Thailand, where we see things improving. So ultimately, ending AIDS would cost much less money than not ending AIDS. Importantly, the actions needed to end AIDS are also key for overcoming other pandemics and key for protecting ourselves against the threats of future pandemics. So we hit three targets at once. When we fight AIDS, we also provide the way to overcome other pandemics, and we protect ourselves from future pandemics. So we can end AIDS by 2030, but the curve will not bend by itself. We have to pull it down together. Thank you. Back to you, Ben.
Thank you so much.
The Doctors Without Borders, of course, were present at the conference and made their point very effectively with their presentations. But they had a press release right at the very beginning that laid out in more detail and with more emphasis even than the UN AIDS Director Winnie Byanyima had put forward. Their press release included the fact that the figures of the fight against HIV show we're moving backwards. The response to the virus is losing coverage and pace. Medicine Sans Frontières teams witness increased difficulties to provide people living with HIV the necessary prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. Our teams report less HIV testing, less treatment initiation, more patients on treatment lost to follow-up, and reduced prevention programs. This is largely due to shortfalls in funding for key HIV interventions. Funding gaps for medical supplies are resulting in stockouts, insufficient availability of drugs, and increased financial barriers for patients. The lack of resources forces rationing of services, and certain communities of people get no or substandard care. The shortfalls also mean that innovative approaches, so important to keep making progress, cannot be implemented. They go on in quite detail, but they also say that this is a political commitment that's needed. The political commitment to solidarity is urgently needed. The international donor community has made political and moral commitments to curb the HIV pandemic and bring it under control. Today, we are not making progress. Instead, we're sliding back. In 2022, the replenishment of the Global Fund presents an opportunity to correct that. However, that the Global Fund is way off target. So this will likely result in even more gaps if international donors don't step in. This is the time to recommit to reversing the dreadful current trends that puts the lives of millions of people living with HIV in balance. They also say there's, for the various tools and treatments, again, it's a political will. Too many patients with AIDS are detected too late. Often diagnostics and medicines to treat them are not available or come at high cost to the patients, unaffordable to most. So this all has to be done in the context of a more political commitment. One of the more encouraging things they talk about is the prevention drugs, CAB-LA, stands for cabotegravir long-acting, which is a new antiretroviral drug as a preventive tool to use in pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, they call it. This prevents new HIV infections in people at high risk. But that, too, has been slowed by a lack of resource or a lack of international commitment. They do go on to as well reinforce that communities have to play a role in HIV programs because we know communities work best. And in that case, they're talking about people on the ground living with HIV. They're talking about communities like the LGBTQ2 communities, etc. Community-led interventions are crucial in the HIV response. They bring prevention, diagnosis, and treatment closer to the patient. Community monitoring of the availability and access to essential medical supplies can leverage the system, but they are crucial to overcome the barriers to care when health systems are under-resourced, substandard, and adapted to the needs of people living with HIV. They write another report. It's much longer. I don't have time, but it's called Burden Sharing or Burden Shifting, How the HIV-TB Response is Being Derailed. An essential read. Please go to Medicine Sans Frontières to take a look at that. At the conference, I ran into a number of Vox Pop videos focusing on key issues such as activists and disruptors rather than the cheerleaders of the Canadian and Quebec government media hacks. They were put together by CATIE, C-A-T-I-E, Canadian AIDS Treatment Information Exchange. And one of them was an interview with Anna Sango from Zimbabwe, who works with the Global Network for People Living with HIV. She spoke very articulately about what people like her are looking for from the conference.
Hi, I'm Christy from CATIE, coming to you from Montreal at the International AIDS Conference, or AIDS 2022. The International AIDS Conference is the largest conference on any health or development issue. And it's unique because people living with HIV and communities affected by HIV are leaders in the conference. I spoke with Anna Sango, Advocacy Officer with GMP Plus, to find out what she thinks people living with HIV are most excited about at this year's conference.
My name is Anna Sango, and I'm based in Harare in Zimbabwe, and I work for the Global Network of People Living with HIV. And my portfolio includes pediatric HIV advocacy and universal health coverage advocacy. I would like to believe efforts around advocacy have been very, very helpful. Advocacy in terms of addressing stigma, advocacy for access to new medicines, as well as advocacy in terms of treatment literacy. I feel that has really come a long way in terms of capacitating as well as equipping people living with HIV to lead fulfilled and better lives with dignity. What we would want to see in terms of the conference is some of the strides that have been made in terms of vaccines, some of the strides that have been made, in terms of a cure, some of the strides that have been made in terms of new HIV prevention tools and technologies, some of the strides that have been made in terms of research. For instance, the PLHIV Stigma Index research, it's led by communities and networks of people living with HIV. So I would hope most of my peers and colleagues and comrades would be really looking out for the data that has come out of that, such that it can help in terms of the advocacy work to address stigma, to address issues to do with discrimination, and also to address some of the barriers that are hindering access for the diverse populations and groups living with HIV. Being involved in research as people living with HIV is very important. I strongly believe that that's where our full capacity can be realized. And it also lets the world know that people living with HIV are more than a statistic. They are progressive human beings. They are community people. They are mothers, they are fathers, they are aunts. They are contributory in terms of the agenda around HIV and AIDS. So when participating in research, we're actually living up to our potential. And it really gives a face to some of the data. It really gives a face and a certain human approach to some of the statistics, because usually one is just considered a number, you know, 1,000 people living with HIV, 1,000,000 people living with HIV, but we never get to see the human face behind that. So as people living with HIV, for part of research, we are part of really humanizing also the efforts that are going to be put together to address the different challenges that are faced. There's a lot that has happened in terms of HIV scientific research, community, and there's so many milestones, and we're very appreciative of some of the work that has been done in terms of developing and having new medicines, new treatment regimens, especially for children. Very passionate about that. It's my line of work. I feel children have been missing in terms of the conversations that are happening. There's still a lot of gaps, and it's really worrisome because they can't be here to speak for themselves. So I feel like that conversation really needs to be heard. We need to stop putting things into silos. We need to find a convergence of how things can be put together. But we really need to prioritize and wake up, because our children are dying.
South African Broadcasting Corporation covered the conference on a daily basis, and their main correspondent was Stephen Letika, who made it very clear that colonialism and racism still rule the world, including the medical response to diseases like HIV/AIDS, COVID, and monkey virus. Here's Stephen Letika being interviewed on South Africa Broadcasting Corporation just before the end of the conference.
The 24th International AIDS Conference, currently underway in Montreal in Canada, is drawing to a close tomorrow. Delegates there include researchers, medical practitioners, activists, and people living with HIV. Now, the conference focuses both on scientific progress in the fight against AIDS and also the need for increased funding for HIV response. It will also explore a range of topics from surveillance ethics and health innovation to HIV cure and vaccine research. For more on this, we're now joined by human rights activist Steve Filitsika, who's of Access Chapter 2. Steve, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Welcome to the program. Thanks for your time. I wonder, what new things have come to light at this particular conference, or are we having the same conversations year after year?
No, Peter. In fact, I think what is quite interesting, beyond conversations that we are used to, of trying to get everybody on track, we know, of course, COVID has disrupted so much, as you have said, but it had pushed us off the mark a little bit across the world, where we have seen that we are not necessarily meeting the targets of reducing the new infections, but also we're not meeting the targets of making sure that people living with HIV have got access to treatment and they are virally suppressed. I think, of course, you know, when you look at conversations that are taking place here, one, it's emphasis of making sure that those who are on treatment is to remind everybody that you equals to you, that, you know, if you take your treatment here and you are virally suppressed, you can actually become undetectable. And I think this is the message that we need to rehash, even in South Africa, that treatment can be used as prevention and we can curb the spread of HIV. But secondly, a reminder of TB. that we cannot talk HIV and not talk about TB. It's one of the biggest challenges in South Africa. It's one of the biggest issues in the world. And lastly, of course, it's around how do we change the narrative? How do we decolonize the funding, financing, and the response and the makeup of what is available? And I think that's the thorny one, you know, as the world, that we reflect on where has the money gone? Where are the resources going now? Because there are competing priorities, climate change and many others. And we've seen it even in our own country. But it's to then say with the little that we have, we can do better and we can use the new technologies, the proven scientific evidence that says reduce, prevent as well as treat.
All right. Tell us a little bit about the session that you presided over. And I'm fascinated to hear looking at racism and AIDS.
Well, I mean, Peter, I think, look, we cannot run away from the historic colonization that we have been experiencing across the world. One thing that is common in the global south in particular has been a colonization. And we share that history of prejudice. But we cannot speak about having a response that does not take the interest of people at heart. At the center of response is the people, is the very same people who are living with HIV, women, children, LGBTI, and many other key and vulnerable population. But when you look at the response, they are not at the center. And at the same time, race plays a significant role. So, of course, issues of class, issues of power and money plays a very critical role. And I think what has been quite important about the narrative is that we have Black excellence. Let's not run away from that. Why are we talking about epidemics in Black or Global South communities, but the response does not carry the knowledge, does not carry the resource investment around that? So I think the narrative has to shift, the resource, the power dynamics, and also naming and not being shying away from what racism has to do with the response that we are seeing and why are we not winning at the same time, because of the very institutional violence, the institutional discrimination, but at the same time, the dominance and power dynamics that exist.
So how do we respond, particularly as a continent?
Look, I think we have demonstrated excellence in the past couple of years as South Africa, as sub-Saharan Africa. We know we are hit by these epidemics. We are the most hit by the epidemics in Africa, where you talk not only of HIV, you talk TB, you talk Ebola, you talk, and even with COVID. But at the same time, is the inequalities that exist, the social and structural inequalities, the economic exclusion is going to carry that center. So where we need to be moving, we need to upscale what has worked in the global south. We need to build solidarity with geographics or areas that are hard or that are difficult. We need to pay attention to tailored interventions. We know exactly what needs to be done. So the resources that, of course, are controlled elsewhere, and they delay even in the health-seeking aspect of it. We need to redirect resources to where it matters. Spend now in order to save later. So what we need to be also doing as country, like our own country, we're developing a new strategic plan. Every 5 years, our current one has come to an end. We know what has worked around prevention. It means we must run. We must not be caught wanting, even with the response on treatment, even with social and structural drivers. I mean, just now, Peter, the president will be hosting presidential social summit. I mean, I fly out, I come back there, and we are already going to be knocking in terms of addressing some of the social and structural drivers.
All right. So I think you started speaking about this a little earlier, but I am curious also about one of the messages of the conference, that if treatment has rendered the viral load undetectable, the virus is no longer transmissible.
Look, I think it has been proven. This is not new just only for this conference. It was said just about 4 years ago that you equals to you. We have 8 million people living with HIV in South Africa. We also have 37 million people living with HIV across the world. If we can get as many as possible, over 95% of people living with HIV, not only just to know their status, but to actually take treatment and adhere, we will get to suppress the viral load. Now, what is the issue and the challenge? And I think the message here about follow the science, invest in the correct measures that are put in place. We know many challenges in Asia, in India. They've got challenges around issues of whether they can test the viral load and they can track and monitor it. Here in South Africa, back home in South Africa, we know we do it. So we need other countries where the burden is mostly high to be able to actually implement the whole U equals to U programming or modeling in full. We don't want people just to be taking treatment and you cannot monitor or track where the viral load is or where the CD4 count is. So the products that are meant to be scientifically helping us to monitor where the epidemic is going needs to be completely done. So what we know and what we understand is that address the elements of behavior, address the elements of treatment, address the social and structural elements. We can beat AIDS by 2030, but only if we spend now, only if we do it right, only if we work together as a collective. Government must take responsibility, civil society and private sector, including the support of development agencies in curbing the HIV response.
And only if we take care of our most vulnerable, which is our young women, how do we help them?
Look, Peter, I think there are quite a number of issues and challenges here, you know, that we always talk about. I think what we have seen is signs of reduction of new infection, even amongst adolescent girls and young women. One of the biggest challenges for us in South Africa, we still do have high new infections per week, 1,200 girls between the ages of 15 to 24 still gets infected weekly in South Africa. Now, we need to lower this. We want to close the tap of new infection, but we can't close it if we are not prepared to speak about teenage pregnancy or statutory rape, if we are not prepared to deal about the economic exclusion, if we are not prepared to talk about behavior of men in society. We are ought to deal even with the role of parents, how young people are equipped, the implementation of comprehensive sexuality education in schools must effectively take charge. And we cannot accept that some social institution want to abuse power, like faith-based sector, who would want to kick out comprehensive sexuality education. It has been proven to be actually excellent scientifically, equipping young people, giving them resilience, knowledge in how they can make the right choices. It's a developmental issue. But at the same time, when we speak about young people, give them agency. Young people understand they are brilliant, they are excellent, they are empowered. And if they're empowered, they will make the right choices. And give them opportunities to participate in other social activities. Don't expect young people will just sit down and relax and while they are confronted by social issues. Don't expect young people not to be part of solutions while we do not create those opportunities for them. So I think we can do better as South Africa. When we say addressing adolescent and young people, we mean ensuring that they are part of decisions. They have a seat on the table. We can't speak about young people without them. Give them that agency.
Steve, always great talking to you. Thank you so much indeed. And we wish you more at the final stages of this conference. And perhaps we can catch up when you get back to give us a comprehensive update. Thanks so much for your thoughts tonight.
Thank you.
All right, human rights activist Steve Letsika of Access Chapter 2, speaking to us all the way from Canada, where the International AIDS Conference is taking place. And new conversations happening, and saying that we can deal with AIDS by 2030 if we do all the right things.
Perhaps the greatest scandal of all was the Canadian government's consistent and continuous refusal of visas to people who are invited to such conferences. And it was embarrassing to open up the conference website and see amongst the very top of the list, first a protest letter from the chairperson who had written a letter to the Prime Minister to protest the fact that there had been such a problem and that they should do something about it. And a whole list of ways for delegates to overcome or compensate for the lack of attendance and how to get their refunds back on their various investments for the conference. The letter started by reading, "The Government of Canada, the host country, has denied visas to many of the participants and delegates, especially those from countries in the Global South. Even before its inauguration, the outgoing president of the conference, Adiba Kamaruglazam, loudly expressed during a press conference the concern that has been on the minds of many in recent times, the risk that the world will deviate from the path in the fight against HIV, and not because there's no information or resources, but because what should be done is not done." The visa controversy, AIDS had been discussed at a meeting that should have served the purpose, since the government of Canada, the host country, has denied visas to many of the participants and delegates, especially those from countries in the Global South, such as the activist Tia Johnson, founder of the African Alliance for HIV Prevention. "I am deeply upset by the high number of denials and visa backlogs that have prevented many registered delegates, including International AIDS Society staff and leadership, from entering Canada," Kamaruglazam complained at the opening ceremony, attributing the difficulty of those attending to a problem of global inequality and systemic racism. Winnie Byanyima herself, director of the United Nations Programme to Fight HIV, UNAIDS, denounced the barriers she encountered with a tweet. "I'm at the Geneva airport, at the boarding gate, with the boarding pass in hand, on the way to #UNAIDS2022, I was almost denied boarding, with all the documents reviewed over and over again, the calls made. I boarded the last flight. Hundreds of people in the South have been denied visas and will not attend. Unfair, racist," she wrote. Well, Canada, you've done it again, and it's a disgusting example of how our immigration policy favors everybody except those with people with color skins colors other than white. And it's not just people outside the country. I've got here another interview with two members of marginalized communities in Canada. This video illustrates how structural factors and social factors can lead to HIV health inequalities among some populations in Canada. It also looks at the critical role played by people in communities affected by HIV in understanding and communicating HIV health inequalities and in developing countries' effective responses to HIV. The intervenants are Muluba Habenyama, who's a Black Canadian, and Trevor Stratton, who is Indigenous.
My name is Muluba, and I've been living with HIV since birth. That'll mark 29 years this year.
My name's Trevor, and I've been living with HIV for 31 years, since 1990.
Living with HIV is not isolating or shameful. It opens up your horizon.
HIV's helped me to connect with my culture, to reconnect with it, and to begin to understand what it means to me to live as an Indigenous person.
Living with HIV means I get to be authentically brave. By authentically brave, I mean in having that power and taking that control to fully take care of myself.
HIV, believe it or not, has really enriched my life in a big way.
Intersecting factors like HIV stigma, anti-Black racism, and misogyny make it very hard for Black women to access the services, supports, and opportunities they should have access to. Social and structural factors like this affect prevention, treatment, and testing. anti-black racism may cause somebody to be under the poverty line, not have access to housing, not have access to food, not have good employment, and many, many more. These factors play a role in why black people may not be getting tested for HIV. It must be noted that not everyone is able to achieve undetectability due to these systematic oppressions that affect their ability to get equitable health care.
People that don't have a say over their own health policies are the ones that seem to be not doing as well. That's where HIV is going. Colonialism produced a lot of disconnection that was really harmful to the health of our peoples. It disconnected us from our traditional systems of learning and our understandings of health. And these came from indigenous ways of knowing and doing, and was replaced by a system that actually wasn't made for us. We were separated from our traditional teachings and we were put into these residential schools, and they weren't ours. This colonial way of education disrupted our whole understanding of health and well-being and holism. These institutions have mistreated Indigenous people so much that it's led to a lot of mistrust. And that means a mistrust for schools, mistrust for hospitals, mistrust for prisons and any other institution is just part of the system. Even sometimes you have to understand our community organizations are viewed as just part of the system that's been hurting me and my family and my community for hundreds and hundreds of years. And residential schools have directly led into, you know, this paradigm of institutional mistrust.
When I look at my peers, friends, associates, I realize, oh, we are a full community. People support each other in many different ways. A lot of the connections that I have been because a black woman has helped me out.
Yes, living with HIV can be a big challenge, and stigma and discrimination is a big deal, but we can also fall back on our culture, our families, and our communities for that strength. And that strength comes from, I believe it comes from culture and our spirituality.
We resource disseminate. If there's a pamphlet, if there's an organization that's really good, we share with each other. And words travel fast.
Our communities who try to take back their language or strengthen the language and the teaching of their language and the value systems, in a lot of cases, cultural practices. Communities that get back to that are striving and creating teachings and taking pride in their ancestral knowledge, those communities are becoming healthier. But we can make culturally safe spaces where people feel comfortable and safe enough to share of their culture and be themselves and start making the space a little bit more like them.
Nothing about us without us. A lot of changes that have been made have come from the community starting to talk about it and demanding action. Really get to know your clients, what lifestyle they're living now, their past, their goals for the future, without any biases, microaggressions, or judgments. Then in talking to your clients about HIV, testing, treatment, prevention, it will be much more comfortable for you and your client.
I think that it's important to walk with people, not force them, not push them, not drag them, but just walk with them on their path, developing that trust and rapport, making human connections. That's how we support people living with HIV.
Finally, I want to give a name to the statistics. My wife's younger sister, Ethel Manda, died of AIDS-related disease, cerebral tuberculosis in this case, in 1997. Here are her daughter, Beria, along with her cousins, Kenny and Rhoda, singing a funeral song as they mourned her death. Malilo, Malilo is funeral. Their pain is evident.
Malilo, 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 Malilo,
tuberculosis is still widespread in Africa, and an AIDS weakened immune system allows it to attack the body everywhere. It was a horrible way for Ethel to die, and in Malawi, family caregivers assist at the hospital. So the girls who were there singing and had lived with her through her slow, painful decline. At that time, in Canada, the antiretroviral treatments had already begun to reverse AIDS-related deaths enormously. But because of the same issues of inequality we face today with patents and corporate greed, Canada, like other rich countries, was quite prepared to let poor black and brown people die in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and the Caribbean, as long as the problem was not on their doorstep. I repeat the Montreal Manifesto of the Coalition des Organismes Communautaires Québécois de Lutte contre le Sida, the Coalition of Quebec Organizations to Combat AIDS. 1. HIV disease remains a worldwide epidemic affecting all countries. It is a human right that every person has the right to a standard of living adequate for their health and well-being, as well as that of their families, which includes food, clothing, housing, and medical care and necessary social services without regard to race, color, sex, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, age, birth, HIV status, or any other characteristics. The manifesto also puts it in terms of global equity. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis must be adequately funded, including targets that reflect actual needs to respond to HIV and the health needs of those living with or most exposed to HIV. It takes political will. The coalition groups have determined we have the means and the knowledge to end HIV transmission now, and the scientific capability to develop preventive and therapeutic vaccines and a cure for HIV, if we commit to adequately funding the response to HIV and actively removing the legal and structural barriers that serve to imperil the health of vulnerable populations the world over. Friends and comrades, we must all recommit to eliminating this terrible scourge and use the same commitment to fight COVID, monkeypox, and any other major disease. I repeat the statistics I started with. Around 650,000 people died from HIV-related causes, while 1.1 million people became newly infected with HIV virus in 2021. They all have names. I'm Doug Miller, and this is Amandla Radio here at CQUT 90.3 FM. We'll be back again next week, but for the moment, stay tuned for Jazz Euphoria.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
MuTech Montreal, the most important festival for digital creativity and electronic music in North America, returns for its 23rd edition at Quartier de Spectacle. From Tuesday, August 23rd to Sunday, August 28th, vibe to the rhythm of more than 100 local and international artists such as Caterina Barbieri, Coro Novoa, Koreatown Acid, Luke Slater, Max Cooper, and Nicola Cruz. MuTech also has a program dedicated to professionals with its MuTech Forum and Market, which consists of 4 days of exchanges and events centered around digital creation. The complete program and tickets are now available at a preferential rate at montreal.mutech.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Union United Church, Cinema Politica, and Catbird Productions are proud to invite you to a special community screening of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardon. This special event will take place in Little Burgundy's historic Union United Church on Thursday, September 1st at 7 p.m., and the screening will be followed by a discussion with the director and participants from the film. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black